You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
With over 8,000 threat hunters analyzing over 65 trillion signals daily, Microsoft works tirelessly with the federal government to keep our nation's data secure. This 30-year-plus partnership is driving mission innovation that is secure by design. Whether optimizing your existing defenses or tackling advanced threats with AI, Microsoft gives you the intelligence and the automation you need to defend at mission scale. Let's work together to stay ahead of emerging threats and secure your mission anywhere. Learn more at aka.ms/fedcyber. That's aka.ms/fedcyber. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CyberWire's Research Saturday. I'm Dave Bittner, and this is our weekly conversation with researchers and analysts tracking down the threats and vulnerabilities, solving some of the hard problems, and protecting ourselves in a rapidly evolving cyberspace. Thanks for joining us.
So this group is, to be totally honest with you, one that I inherited and has been tracked in, you know, our space, the call it the vendor threat research space, since roughly 2017, but probably going back further than that.
That's Greg Lesniewicz, senior threat researcher at Proofpoint. The research we're discussing today is titled From Social Engineering to DMARC Abuse, TA-427's Art of Information Gathering.
And you can sort of think about it as the West team, or the cluster of activity from the Kim Suki umbrella, if we want to use that term, that targets people like policy experts that work either in government or for NGOs or think tanks, and they send a lot of phishing emails to those people. And so they've been around for a long time. We observed some changes in their tactics and in their targeting, and that led to the blog saying, hey, we think we've seen, you know, enough of a change that we should alert the general public. And part of that comes from the fact that they tend to target a lot of personal addresses and groups and companies that don't necessarily have the most mature or high-end security programs. And so sometimes getting information out to alert the, you know, that sort of policy and think tank and North Korean watching space can be the best thing to help prevent this group from being successful in their operations.
Mm. And you mentioned North Korea. I mean, we're fairly confident in saying here that this is an operation from them.
Yes. A big portion of that comes from U.S. government attribution of previous things that we've tracked at this from this cluster. I would say that there is consensus among those that track North Korean activity full-time that this is also North Korea.
I see. Well, let's talk about what their particular interests are here. I mean, who are the kinds of people that they're targeting?
The kinds of people they're targeting, I think, can really be well described by the kind of people they spoof. Because the kind of people they spoof tend to be very well-known North Korean watchers, if that's, you know, a term that rings a bell for anybody. And they'll spoof sort of prominent people in the North Korean sort of policy space, and not people in North Korea doing policy, but particularly people based in the U.S., who have insight or potentially can contribute to policies that would affect North Korea. And so they target individuals that have some idea, can inform those policies, or have particular analytical skills that could provide some insight for North Korea about what those policies will be. And so something like, you know, there's sort of a steady drumbeat of this activity that is targeting these people all the time. And part of that is to, we believe, is for the group to sort of stay in touch with the heartbeat of what the North Korean community is, you know, caring about. And some of it is then more particular in, you know, its engagement. And a lot of that just derives from, hey, South Korea announces that they are removing the reunification language from their constitution. TA-427 will then come and ask experts and say, is this actually going to affect policy or is this just sort of a stance change? Hmm. They won't ask it as elegantly as I just said it or as basically as I've just said it. You know, but they tend to have, in my opinion, what they're interested in can be very well derived from the questions they ask in their emails. And those almost always go to people in government, but more so to people at think tanks and NGOs in those sort of spaces. And occasionally, we don't have necessarily the data to say that it's going to a ton of journalists, but you know, given that they spoof journalists a good amount of times, we would expect that journalists who write about North Korea a lot are also targeted.
So is it fair to say this is a collegial exchange where they'll reach out to someone and say, hey, you're an expert on North Korea's nuclear disarmament. Good news. So am I. Let's talk shop.
Yeah, it will definitely tend to start that way. Mm. There will tend to be a question or sort of a hook in there, but all of it is not. It ignores all of the things or avoids all of the things that we tend in like the phishing space to advise people to look out for. You know, there's no talk about accounts. There's no sort of language that is pushy or conveying a sense of urgency. And nor is there an amount of like, hey, you should read this email, like trying to make it seem important. It does a lot to try and blend in compared to how some of the business email compromise emails might do it. And so there will tend to be a question or a topic in there very related to current events surrounding the Korean Peninsula. We, in fact, just saw one today talking about how potential changes in the Japanese majority party and elections in South Korea might affect, quote unquote, policies in Northeast Asia. And so there'll be some amount of, you know, it won't always directly say, hey, how will this affect North Korea? But you can sort of derive that sort of intent. And so there's sort of a bifurcation of things that can happen after that. We've seen reports, particularly out of the folks from Reuters put out a piece, I think in 2022, where they first saw this activity that they would solicit these questions in the way you just sort of termed it collegial, and they would get a response back. Hey, what do you think about this topic? The victim will say, hey, I think that X, Y, and Z policies are going to create A, B, and C outcomes. And sometimes they'll just drop the conversation there and say, okay, I've got what I need. Cool. Thank you. We believe that some of that activity can be them getting answers to questions that their leadership has to them. You know, everybody has a boss that they're answering to in this space.
Right.
And if they can get the answer without having to do, you know, complete, you know, more effort, you know, why would you continue with the normal playbook? We are a little bit biased in that, I'll note, because we want to interdict as soon as we see, you know, contact with a North Korean intelligence operative. So we tend to technology and then from our advisement end, cut off that communication as soon as possible so that the victim can't even respond. So we've seen reports of you know, the sort of call and response and then completion of that email thread. We've seen reports and observed in our data as well, sort of longer or attempted longer exchanges, especially with the victim's personal accounts. So they will email their corporate or, you know, professional account and CC their Gmail account, and they will continue to respond from their Gmail account. And that can go on for, you know, months at a time without necessarily something super malicious happening. And part of that is, I think, trust building. But also if, you know, from my view, if someone has a source that they can keep tapping with low effort to get a good idea of what someone thinks about something. I think it's something that they'll continue to pursue without necessarily needing to deploy malware or harvest credentials in some manner, especially if going through that bulk of information that exists just on someone's computer is more effort than it's worth, especially if they're getting the information directly from the user, you know, the voice themselves. So it's a pretty interesting set of activity. Definitely not the sexiest, but you know, definitely the most prolific group on the APT side of things that we see in our data.
Yeah. One of the things that this research that you all just published highlights is how they've sort of upped their game a little on the email side of using things like DMARC and some web beacons. Can you take us through what you're seeing there?
Yeah. And on the second one of those web beacons, it's effectively like something like marketing click tracking to see, hey, has this person opened our emails, to get an idea of how successful a given campaign has been. Mm. And they've sort of been testing with those same things. We haven't seen widespread adoption, but we think it was sort of to get an idea of, are my emails landing? Are they landing in the right place? Even it might just be as simply as, are victims opening my emails? And not something as nefarious as, are they coming out of the right IP address, or is some other technology, you know, effectively clicking on these links for these people?
I see.
The second one of these that you mentioned was the DMARC abuse. And that was something that we first started observing in December 2023, effectively coming out of accounts that TA427 has compromised for a really long time. We're trying to work with the folks that are compromised and sending, you know, are facilitating sending those emails. So we didn't name them in the piece because, you know, it didn't feel like a professional move to sort of call out people that might not be able to prevent those things on their own. And so right. Trying to put out as much information as we can to say, hey, here's how you can protect yourself against the threat without doing sort of like the inverse of the victim shaming. Sort of thing. So peeling back a little bit, or stepping back a little bit, DMARC is the thing that was getting used or abused rather in that second instance, where effectively DMARC is an authentication sort of agreed upon protocol in the email space where, you know, if I have my website, call it funhats.com, I can attach a DNS record to that that would be dmarc.coolhats.com that would then provide, and it's the response, if you query it in, I believe, the text record, it would tell you, hey, this has a DMARC policy of X, Y, and Z.
Okay.
Those policies can then dictate, you know, does a policy exist, yes or no? What are sort of the parameters of those policies? And effectively, the parameters of those policies is where we saw spoofed entities getting abused. If my policy record says a policy exists, but it's not enforced, or to not, you know, during the authentication process, if someone sending an email as coolhats.com fails to authenticate, like that DMARC authentication fails, a lot of policies will just say, do nothing, instead of quarantine or reject it and then tell the entity that was spoofed that they were being spoofed. And so, it's kind of a tricky thing to set up. And, you know, there's a ton of things on YouTube and the open internet about how to set that up. But it is a little bit of an intensive process. And so given that we hadn't seen, you know, as much adoption as we would hope for or like, we're sort of in a place where we have to say, okay, well, you know, these entities are being abused. We can, you know, sort of try to tell them to update their DMARC records to prevent this spoofing. But it does allow, you know, the TA427 in the end to very well spoof someone like my domain, coolhats.com. And it does all the things, again, to what we said before, it beats all of the measures that we tell people to look for in a phishing email, because everything in the header says it's coming from Greg at coolhats.com.
Right.
You know, there's no sort of like difference between those two, unless you know how to open the email headers and inspect those and check them, or you're flagging for failed DMARC activity. It's not necessarily something that would bubble up without some other technology in line to tell you, hey, this might be an imposter. Don't engage with them or sort of proceed with caution. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of the main impetus for us wanting to get some information out there about this activity.
We'll be right back. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
To what degree would you label this sort of a low-level espionage? I mean, it doesn't sound like they're actively trying to, you know, infiltrate classified information. It strikes me that this is kind of a taking a temperature of what people who have professional interest in these topics may be thinking about things. Is that a fair way to assess what's going on?
Yeah, I think definitely from what their goals are, I think that's a fair way to assess it. I think espionage is sort of the closest proxy. You could also make the argument that it is sort of, you know, there's no embassy, North Korean embassy in Washington, D.C. And some of this activity, you could sort of imply that it's replacing that. I know that Jenny Town from Stimson Center has sort of made that point, and I tend to generally agree with it, that it's replacing diplomats and ambassadors being on the ground and rubbing shoulders with sort of the think tank and policy folks on a day-to-day basis, where you might not, you know, if you know someone is North Korean, you might not tell them everything, but they can still potentially attend your talk or listen to your testimony somewhere and sort of get information that way. And so it definitely feels very human driven rather than like cyber-driven espionage. It's sort of just email. Email is just the most convenient vector for it happening. We do see it occasionally leading to credential harvesting or malware infections, which does sort of keep it in that sort of quote-unquote cyber domain. And so I think that it just kind of blurs the line because of the inauthentic nature of the activity and it being, you know, government or state sponsored, that we continue to bucket it as espionage, but it's sort of not as neat as something like, you know, another North Korean group, like TA-404, which also could be tracked as Diamond Sleet, targeting defense contractors and trying to steal missile plans.
Right.
That sort of directly falls into the espionage thing. We don't want that. You know, they're like, All sorts of levers that can be pulled about that. And this is just sort of a constant stream of questions that you could very well see the regime asking through sort of a proxy. And, you know, part of it is just telling people to not engage with potentially North Korean citizens and personnel. But to your point, yeah, it sort of doesn't really fit into a neat box of espionage or sort of the non-espionage based information gathering that happens at embassies worldwide.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what are your recommendations then? I mean, in terms of strategies for folks to be aware of this, protect themselves, and I suppose part of this is helping spread the word as well.
Yeah, and so I think broadly, not everyone, I think, has the same risk profile that academics and people in think tanks and NGOs have for getting random emails from people that, you know, purport to know them. At a narrow focus, if you're in the North Korean watching or think tank or NGO community, those is sort of like the cyberspace, you know, like the cyber threat intelligence, threat research spaces tend to be pretty small. And so even if you don't know that person directly, you probably have a 1 degree or 2 degree of separation to ask through the grapevine to say, hey, did this person actually ask me to write a paper for them? Or were they asking my opinion about something or to attend this event? Or was it not them? And we should sort of throw the flag up and tell the rest of the community. The tricky part with this activity as a whole is guidelines and sort of advice to the general public. The only real one that comes to mind is when the sender and the reply to address are different. So if you click, you know, you sort of have to do the dance of in Outlook or Gmail, clicking reply to the email and seeing that the address that sent that email is not the address you're sending something back to. Mm. And then going from there to say, okay, the thing that emailed me was coolhats.com to you know, overuse that example over and over again.
Right, right.
But it's the actual address that I'm replying to is a Hotmail account. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of disparate and different enough to raise suspicion on my end? And that, unfortunately, is just something that comes with probably being targeted by these folks before and learning that is something that could happen to you. And to be honest, awareness tends to be, to your last point, awareness tends to be the best way that community has to interdicting and preventing these threats. I'm not in any of these communities, but in engaging with a couple of people that are, someone will say, hey, you know, we'll ask someone like a Jenny Town, who's at Stimson Center. She runs a program called 38 North that does a lot on North Korea. And we'll ask, hey, is this your email? This, you know, call it a from a free mail provider. Is this you or is this, you know, North Korea, for lack of a better term?
Right.
She'll say, no, I don't control that account. And then on our end, we'll do sort of our normal technical work. The think tank folks will then go spread the word, say, hey, be on the lookout for this email address because it's not actually me. Don't reply to anything. Certainly don't reply and antagonize them. And you know, don't provide any information over. And some of that is, I think that we just don't want anyone to be engaging with these folks, because even if we can keep a slight amount of information advantage over North Korea, you know, most of their other cyber programs are centered around them acquiring information or currency to further their weapons program, which, you know, there's a lot of black and white in the world, or a lot of shades of gray in the world right now to decide, you know, what's good and what's bad. I think that deciding, you know, helping prevent North Korea from getting a long-range nuclear weapon is very much a good thing to do.
Yeah, not very ambiguous.
So it sort of
yeah.
becomes an easy thing for us all to sort of center around.
Right, right. I think it's a really interesting point, you know, that because I could imagine if I'm a policy expert and the very fact that someone is reaching out to me, there's a certain bit of flattery that goes with that. But then also if it's obvious to me that this is, you know, someone wearing a fake mustache and a trench coat and a hat, that it isn't actually the person that they say they are, I can understand being a smart person that thinking, oh, I might string them along for a little while. But, you know, this may be North Korea's B team, but they may bring in the A team if you aggravate them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And even though we have not used the sophisticated word yet, that, you know, I think that the level of English that they are able to use in their Word documents, you know, everybody sort of makes mistakes, but the level of English, the amount, the sort of things they're able to discuss, even just via email in a written format, not, you know, live and on the phone or something like that, is impressive. And so I think that, you know, they have proven themselves pretty capable just in this arena alone. And we sort of know, or we sort of suspect, we do not know, but that operators from sort of this group and potentially the other parts of the Kim, quote unquote, Kim Suki umbrella got pulled in to sort of a tiger team during the COVID response from North Korea. And they were doing things that were well above sort of the normal TTP capability we would assign them in sort of their daily operations. And so we know that that ceiling is higher than this activity is showing us. And so I think that that's also, to your point, a big part of keeping things calm through those engagements and saying, hey, you know, even though that this isn't the most malign thing that you've ever seen, aggravating them is just not going to help anybody.
Right, right.
And they definitely do have some, I think within their sort of repertoire, they have some, you know, pretty capable malware families like Recon Shark, which is a updated version of Baby Shark, a Visual Basic VBS based family that, you know, it's pretty well detected and easy to track if you're looking at it, but it's not something that they use all the time. They will use a lot of things like browser extensions to sort of steal passwords and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I think even with those sort of small selection of tooling, I think that they, because of the apparatus that, you know, the North Korean apparatus that they're tied to, there can be a bigger hammer to get rolled out if it's needed.
Our thanks to Greg Lesniewicz from Proofpoint for joining us. The research is titled From Social Engineering to DMARC Abuse, TA-427's Art of Information Gathering. We'll have a link in the show notes. And now a word from our sponsor, SpyCloud, the leader in operationalizing cybercrime analytics. Traditional threat intelligence is a thing of the past. Cyber criminals are stealing vast amounts of credentials, session cookies, and financial data every day, and it's hard to keep up. SpyCloud is the trusted partner businesses turn to fully understand their darknet exposure risk and neutralize threats before it's too late. SpyCloud alerts your organization as soon as an employee or customer's data appears on the darknet, so you can act faster than bad actors to prevent cyber attacks like ransomware, session hijacking, account takeover, and online fraud. With insights from the industry's largest repository of recaptured data, protect the digital identities and systems most important to your business. Get your free corporate darknet exposure report at spycloud.com/cyberwire and see what information criminals have in their hands today. That's spycloud.com/cyberwire. The CyberWire Research Saturday podcast is a production of N2K Networks. N2K Strategic Workforce Intelligence optimizes the value of your biggest investment, your people. We make you smarter about your team while making your team smarter. Learn more at n2k.com. This episode was produced by Liz Stokes. Our mixer is Elliot Peltzman. Our executive producers are Jennifer Iben and Brandon Karp. Our executive editor is Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here next time.